Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is screenwriter in film and TV, David Stokes. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well. I'm excited to do this. It's a while since I've done a sort of film-themed five. I've done lots of advice fives of late, but not films. So I've done downer endings in the past, and I've done best sci-fis, but you went for five great abrupt endings. Now, before we get into specifics as to the five you've chosen, we'll do them one at a time, and we'll do them in reverse date order. Do you want to talk about, just generally, about, I don't know, from a writer's point of view, maybe the technique of using an abrupt ending, or even why they appeal to you?
I don't know what it is. I love the fact that some movies have kind of, that the director is so confident in the story that they can just, or maybe not even confident, but they just can kind of go, that's it. You get no more. You don't get a happy ending. You don't get this. You don't get that. It's just, this is it. This is the story. I mean, a couple of my choices are absolute, like, perfect examples of abrupt endings, I hope.
Yeah.
But I've always loved them. I mean, I grew up in like the 80s watching horror movies far too young. And I think they had a massive impact on me.
Yeah.
Because so many of the films back then had these crazy abrupt endings because they were kind of like jump scares. Some of them were jump scares. And yeah, I've always loved them. And to this day, I still dream of putting an abrupt ending in something that I've written. It might be in the thing I'm writing now, that another horror movie that might work very well with an abrupt ending. But I would love to do one because I think they're great.
A past guest on here, Gerard Johnson, who made Tony, and he made Hyena, and he made Muscle. There are three films. He's right. Definitely a fan of the abrupt or maybe a bleak ending, you know, where you feel like there's more to give, but the film's going, no, I'm going to stop there. I recently rewatched his second film, Hyena, and that's really building to a boil. And then it just goes, do you know what? I don't need to tell you anymore. You know how this pans out. So I'm just going to leave you with the sort of antsy thought of did he or didn't he?
I do love an ambiguous ending, ambiguous and abrupt. I mean, the last movie I wrote, called Goodnight, which was a horror, that had a massively ambiguous ending. And weirdly, I thought it would be very divisive, like when everyone read it. But everyone seems to love it. Everyone loves the fact that I don't give it it's this or it's this. It's just kind of like, I'm going to stop it there and you decide what happens a day after this. Because I find it more interesting. I don't like spoon feeding an audience. I don't want to insult their intelligence.
I must admit, I've done it myself of late. And I think in a way, if your film has built up the dread to a point where you've got this kind of ding-a-ling-a-ling moment and you don't need to sort of then explain yourself after the fact, it's there to think about. And that's, you know, all the best horrors that I've watched often leave me with that lingering thought or lingering doubt as to what maybe I have or haven't seen. And we'll get to that in one of your examples, certainly in one of your examples. Let's get into it. So the rules of the game are simple. You've given me five films with abrupt endings. We're going to run through them one at a time. We're going to spend 5 minutes roughly speaking, when the bell goes, that's our time to stop. It's not because there isn't more to say. It's because I just want to ensure that we get to spend an equal amount of time on each of the films. Also, it makes me a hell of a passive-aggressive host because I'm deferring I'm deferring to a bell, not my own discipline. So without further ado, we're going to get into the first one. I'm going to start the clock. And the first one is 1975's Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Do you want to talk us through, like, the ending is obviously very related to how the film is wildly structured in the first place.
I mean, I grew up, my dad loved Monty Python, so I kind of grew up around it. And it's just a brilliant ending. Because, I mean, for years when I was much younger, I just figured they didn't know how to finish the ending. They just kind of, oh, they ran out of money or something. And it's just kind of like, it's this medieval, ridiculous jaunt. And then, oh, the police arrive and they arrest everyone and throw them into vans.
I must admit, David, when I was when you gave me your list, I was thinking, yeah, when I was a kid, it really ruined it because I wasn't sophisticated enough in my mind to understand the absurdity of it.
Yeah, I mean, because as I later found out, apparently it was Michael Palin's idea. The original idea they had was 50% in the Middle Ages and 50% in modern day.
Ah, right.
But apparently they improvised so much that they pretty much abandoned their original idea. And then it was Palin's suggestion. They kind of went, look, we don't know where to end this, so why don't the police show up and arrest us all? And they all went, brilliant. Because it's just insanity. And it's the perfect Monty Python ending because it makes no sense whatsoever. It's just brilliant.
But they do wonderfully seed it, though, don't they? Because you have the kind of break, like Blazing Saddles in the canteen. You do have this kind of break with the film.
Yeah.
And the fourth wall is well and truly broken.
Oh, that's another brilliant example. Yeah. Blazing Saddles. The end of the Blazing Saddles where, you know, Dom DeLuise shows up and they're all doing the dance number. It's just incredible.
But in a way that, you know, Holy Grail's first sort of, it stops, doesn't it, in partway through. And it's like, oh, hold on a minute, what are you doing? And we've got the and we have the historian and all that. So we're aware that this is possible. So it's not as absurd as it might first feel once you sort of begin to unpack how the film is structured.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a great way of, I mean, it's Python all the way through. You know, Python were always the kind of, you are not going to predict what happens next because we could do anything.
Mm.
We'll do absolutely anything if we think it's funny. And I think, you know, of all the movies, that's Holy Grail is probably the one where they kind of went, yeah, it's this ending. We've decided. You can find it funny or not, but we think it's funny. And I love that. I love when comedians just do stuff because they think it's funny. They don't care if other people find it funny. And I love that.
Because in a way, because I think if I remember rightly, I saw Life of Brian before I saw Monty Python and the Holy Grail, even though Life of Brian is the more modern film of the two, which obviously has a straightforward story. And then equally, you've got Jabberwocky as well, which is a tad more off the wall. And I think that maybe speaks to the fact that they're so willing to experiment with the form. That it can,
absolutely, yeah.
When it doesn't hit, it can, because Jabberwocky is a tougher watch and it's not as hit. It's more missed than hit, but it's interesting. But whereas Monty Python and the Holy Grail has got umpteen what you would call sketches, really, but because it's a mission, each sketch is taking one further step along the path to finding the Holy Grail. You know, it's sort of, it's a really simple thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, they used to write them by just going, this is the subject, and they go away and write something funny on this subject as teams. And then they would come back and go, well, I've got a scene where this happens, and I've got a scene where this happens. And they would just clump it all together and make a narrative out of it. I think it was like John Cleese and Graham Chapman. They were a writing team. Eric Idle and I think Palin were a writing team together. So, yeah, they would just all go away and come back with the funniest stuff and go, well, that could go there, this could go there, that could go there. And then, yeah, they just came up with a very silly ending because Monty Python were very silly, and God bless them.
And it's interesting rewatching it because it's absurd, but it's not funny, if that makes sense.
Exactly. Yeah.
It turns the film into a very serious ending, even after, you know, Graham Chapman's been covered in a bucket of shit before that moment happens.
Yeah. It's fantastic. It's like, it's just, that's what it is. You know, it's one of those things, like some endings are so bad they ruin the film. Mm. You know, you can watch a film and then the ending's so bad, you're kind of like, that was rubbish. But Holy Grail is one of the few examples where it's like, yeah, that ending is really odd, but I'm still going to watch it another 50 times because I know it's going to make me laugh every time I watch it.
Yeah, and I was grateful, really, that recently it landed on Netflix, and I realised I hadn't watched it for so long, but it was like putting on a pair of old shoes.
Yeah.
It's
brilliant.
Such
it doesn't matter how
film.
Old they get. Yeah, doesn't matter how old.
Oh, hello. First one. First alarm goes. I think we all heard that, didn't we?
I think so.
Right then, jumping 6 years into the future, we've got the abrupt ending that goes with An American Werewolf in London. Do you want to talk us through what that abrupt ending is?
Yeah, I mean, spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen a 41-year-old film. But the ending is David Kessler, who's the main character in it, he becomes a werewolf. And he turns into a werewolf in a porn cinema in Piccadilly Circus at the end and goes on a rampage of like werewolves do. And he ends up in a dead end alley and the police are there and there's machine guns and he's completely cornered. And his girlfriend, who's the nurse, tries to reason with this monster. And for a second, you think he's listening to her and then it launches itself at her. And the police shoot it dead. There's a shot of the nurse crying. There's a shot of David dead on the floor, full of bullet holes, and it cuts to black instantly. Mm. And then the song Blue Moon plays over it.
David. They're going to kill you. David. Please. Please let me help you. I love you, David.
And it's just like, that's exactly what that ending should be. John Landis's choice to make that the ending, I think, is genius. Because it's like, that's the story. He's dead. You don't need to worry about what she does after that or how they react to a werewolf in running around in London. It's like, that was David's story. It started here. It ended there. Mm. That's all you're getting. Fantastic endings. Probably my favorite of all of the endings on this list. I love American Werewolf in London.
In what makes it your favorite? What makes the decision so right? Because obviously it's the film is building momentum at that point, isn't it? It's like it's very much a will he or won't he get caught? And obviously getting cornered feels like literally there's no way out, and it proves to be true.
Yeah, I think it's just like if I look at the other ones, the others are great endings, hence the reason why I've picked them. But there's something about American Werewolf in London, because all the way through, it's funny, then it's scary, then it's funny, then it's scary. There is nothing funny about the last 5 minutes of that movie. It's horrific. People have run over, people have smashed out of buses and car crashes, and it's brutally violent. People are decapitated. And then the lead character is shot to death. And then you just see his dead body on the floor. It's so visceral. And it's like, you know, the whole way through, they're like, this is a horror comedy. This, you know, let's hold your hand and it's going to be horrible. It's going to be funny. And at the end, they just kind of go, that's the ending, because this is never going to have a happy ending. He had to die. All werewolves die.
I'd forgotten that the I Love You moment, which is a grown woman telling a wolf beast, where she can obviously see past the transformation into the beast and tell him that she loves him, I guess with the hope of reaching him. But it's that idea of, we start off with this, the film obviously has the natural cynicism that there is no such thing as werewolves, and by the end of it, we're loading guns with silver bullets.
That's what I love about it, is the fact that it's, I mean, the creature's just incredible. Rick Baker was a genius, let alone talking about the transformation and all that. Mm. But that monster at the end of that alleyway, and she's trying to talk to it, and she says, I love you. And for a split second, you see this snarl kind of drop very slightly, like it heard her. And then it snarls again and just launches at her. Because so there was a tiny piece of David Kessler still listening, but he wasn't strong enough to stop it. And he just tried to kill it. And so they shot it dead. And I'm just like, genius, absolute genius. I loved it.
And it's such a, and like you say, it's such a great location for it to all take place, because it's not like in the boondock somewhere. It's right in the middle of central London. You know, it's iconic in every way where it's taking place. So the chaos a loose werewolf would cause is palpable.
I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, the fact alone that they did that for real, I think from watching the making of, I think it was like 3 or 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning.
Okay.
Or something crazy. They had it for a few hours. They closed the whole thing down. I can't imagine they could even close Piccadilly Circus down now.
No.
I mean, you'd have to be a huge director to get, which Spielberg might be able to get away with it. But back then it was just like, yeah, we need this.
And I don't think anyone would want to be bothered with the cost these days.
Yeah. I mean, the closest thing really, I suppose, actually, now I've said that, is 28 Days Later, where they actually did do that for real, which again is an astonishing visual of London being empty.
Although having ventured into London since the pandemic, most mornings seem to feel like 28 Days Later.
It was
later.
Like that, yeah. Yeah. Eerie. Crazy. Oh, there we go.
There we go again. Let's reset the clock and just jump a couple more years into what essentially is like, what feels like my heyday for VHS watching. And to be fair, actually, this is one that in my VHS watching days, I wasn't allowed to watch when when I was 12. In fact, I was 11 when this came out. We'd seen Cannibal Holocaust, which was a shock to the whole family. And then once that shock had got over, Spit in Your Grave and Evil Dead were definitely off the table. My dad watched them, but I wasn't allowed. So, do you want to talk us through I'm in fact talking about the abrupt ending that is Evil Dead from 1983.
Yeah, well, like you, I saw Evil Dead. It came out in 83. I think it was out for a little while, then it was immediately banned by the BBFC. I think I saw it, my uncle got it us on a VHS, and I was probably 8 or 9, and they were like, do you want to watch this? And I was like, hell yeah, I do. And so we watched Evil Dead, and I just thought it was, I mean, I love Evil Dead 2 more, because that's funny, but the Evil Dead ends, there's no comedy in it at all. It's just complete horror all the way through.
Mm.
And, you know, Bruce Campbell is Ash, and he's just beaten from pillar to post the entire movie. And you think, oh, he's done it. He's got away with it. And then you see the evil cam, force cam, whatever they call it, and it flies through the woods, over water, through the cabin, and he turns around and it just goes straight into his face and he screams, and it immediately cuts to black, and then it plays ragtime music, which is the best music ever to play over, because it goes from horrific horror to kind of this upbeat, jingly jangly music, which is just amazing. Again, it's just a brilliant abrupt ending because I hate horror movies with happy endings as a rule, and I love them when they don't. And this is like, this guy was beaten up so badly through the entire movie, and then you think he's got away with it, and he steps outside the cabin, and then something gets him. The thing that's been trying to get him for the whole film, it gets him at the end. Genius.
Well, loved yeah, because it. Yeah, it's that last sort of 5 minutes. 10 minute spell before it finally comes to get him is the severe beating as someone's going to get while off sort of two demonified prior friends of his. So they're not, you know, he gouges out the eyes of one of them, and he's getting beaten with a fire poker for a fire for the entire time he's trying to get the Book of the Dead before he throws it in the fire, and then we get that lovely. Almost like ethereal music, which is the coda for everything's okay, save the day.
Everything's fine.
And then
exactly, yeah.
And then, but the audience
pulls the rug.
And then the audience is privy to, no, the film's not ended. That isn't the end. He hasn't solved anything. Yep. And again, a bit like the Monty Python thing is that you as an audience visually have already had this sort of fed to you in the way that the evil has worked throughout, the way that the evil first arrived is obviously how it ends.
That's it.
And it feels, I mean, in that sense, while it is abrupt, it's also very apt. It doesn't feel like you've been wrong-footed.
No.
Unless, of course, you wanted Ash to live, kind of thing, in that sort of sense of the hero not seeing the end of the film.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, I mean, he's such an anti-hero. And, you know, that's why, I mean, Ash Williams? I think that's what they ended up calling him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even now people love Bruce Campbell because of that one character, you know, because he's not a hero. He's an everyman thrown into a situation, and he tries his best and just gets the shit beaten out of him. But he's just like a Duracell bunny. He just never quits. He never, ever quits. And I love the fact that in the second one, which was basically a remake of the first one, they show you what happens after the first one ends, which is it picks him up and throws him through the trees and everything. So that kind of dilutes the ending of the first one a bit because they kind of play it for laughs a little bit, but it's just a brilliant ending to an astonishing horror film.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine watching it with 2022 eyes, anybody thinking to ban this film, but we were talking about it was the Video Nasty Panic of the early 80s, and you're right, a year later, we had the 1984 Video Recording Act, and this was one of the 39 films that got banned. I mean, it's quite hysterical.
And when it got re-released years later, it was cut to ribbons. Oh, there we go.
No, go and finish your thought. What was that, sorry?
Yeah, no, like, because it was banned. I mean, I know the things like there was a pencil in the ankle and that is horrible. But yeah, when it finally got released, I think it was in the 90s it got released on VHS for the first time, and it was just cut to ribbons. The shock had gone from it because they just chiseled all of the edges off it. It was like Evil Dead Light, and it was
awful. Then over time...
Because I remember seeing the uncut version.
I was going to say over time, though, the uncut version we're nearer to the uncut version than... I mean, I don't think it's completely pre-certified, but it's as good as.
Yeah, I think the uncut version is out now. I mean, God, I think Evil Dead 2 is even like a 15 on Blu-ray now. It's not even an 18. You know, that they are relaxing massively with violence in movies.
The problematic thing with Evil Dead was obviously the rape by tree roots scene. I mean, everything else was just buckets of blood and silly effects, whereas that was sexual violence, and that was the big thing that the British censors were hot on.
And it is super gnarly. Even now, it's kind of like, wow, that's a step too far.
Yeah, and with the use of that camera that is sort of very penetrative anyway, the way that it races through the trees and stuff, this is a force that can't be stopped, and obviously it proves to be the case in that instance. Moving on to choice number four, this one is probably the most contentious one for me. Not that it's not a good or bad choice, but in terms of the four films, it's the one where the abrupt ending pissed me right off, if I'm honest with you.
Really?
Yeah, so do you want to talk us through the abrupt ending of the Blair Witch Project from 1999?
When I'd heard of the Blair Witch Project, it had barely been mentioned anywhere, and people were saying that this was like the most amazing horror film. Mm. And then it hadn't even been released in England. I bought a DVD from America and had it shipped over because I had a region-free DVD player. Okay. And I watched it with my best friend in the dark at like midnight. And when that film ended, we went cold, like goosebumps, and we froze. And I remember him going home that night and telling me, it was like, I was shitting myself walking home. That film like scared him to his core. And there's just something so good. So, I mean, the ending is, for those who haven't seen it, it's three film students trying to make a documentary in the middle of the woods about a supposed witch, and weird things go horribly wrong. One of them goes missing, and they track these people down to an old house in the woods. And you see everything from a camera's point of view, the person's point of view holding the camera. And then they walk into the basement, and one of the people is standing in the corner of the room, staring at the corner, which was foreshadowed at like minute 15 in the film, which you would have forgotten about at that point. And then something hits the woman holding the camera. The camera drops and it runs out of film, which now is a massive cliche because so many found footage movies now end with a camera dropping and the camera turning off. But back then, other than like Cannibal Holocaust, maybe, and I can't even remember how that ended because I've only seen it once.
Josh, is that you down there? Josh.
When that happened and the camera drops, you just, it's like a bucket of water to the face. For me, it was just kind of like, oh,
no,
my
no.
God,
and I envy how you got to watch it then, because for me, I saw it when it was having its long run at the cinema. I'd not managed to see it, and it was obviously being billed as the greatest thing since sliced bread. Well, anything with that level of expectation cannot be that good. And I just couldn't watch it with sort of open arms going, come on, scare the bejesus out of me. I'm like, I'm just watching it going, prove to me you're the best horror film ever made. Prove to me.
Exactly,
I mean,
yeah.
I've watched it since, and it is a work of genius. I mean, it's not...
Yes.
I don't hold that view that it was pissed me right off. It's just that at the time, I was in such the wrong frame of mind to watch it, whereas now, watching it, it is just great, because why would it just... The point is the film runs out. That's the story. If it's found footage, then there's no one else to capture what happens next. So that's the terrifying thing. And because we don't get an answer... really, as to the whatever the Blair Witch horror is, we know something supernatural is there, and doing malevolent things, but it's not something we understand in this world.
Yeah, I mean, what I loved about the ending, and it's something that is not necessarily a 90s thing, because no one had done it before, but they certainly don't do it now. When she screams and something hits her and the camera hits the floor, that camera lies on the floor for 13 seconds before it cuts off, because I timed it. But getting ready for this to go, how long is that shot at the end?
Nice.
And it's 13 seconds of silence and the floor. And then it just cuts to black with eerie music. And it's just kind of like, you know, they could have dropped it and cut it instantly. But the fact they let it go and go and go, it's like, yeah, that was brilliant. I mean, because like, I watched it on a little computer monitor in the dark. And all I knew was that this movie had hit Sundance and people were going nuts about it. And, you know, I remember seeing much later on, there was a video of people coming out of the Sundance showing and they were completely traumatized because at the time they were saying it was a documentary and they thought they'd genuinely seen three people die, which is an amazing piece of marketing. Mm. They were completely traumatized by it.
Absolutely.
And so I knew it wasn't real. But my God, that ending is effective. If you know nothing about the film, you go into it cold. It's an amazing ending.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I hopefully people who've been attracted to listen to five great abrupt endings aren't worried about spoilers, because that's what we're talking about. And it's interesting you say how much
I'm afraid
it is. It's amazing how much you say it is indeed a cliche. But it still wasn't a cliche by 2008 when Cloverfield did the same trick.
Exactly.
Which is to end the film on the camera being dropped as the person holding it is no longer with us. But it's interesting that even as, but also that speaks to how much of a groundbreaking film the Blair Witch Project was. And I think that, you know, it's no surprise that the people who made it really couldn't really ever live up to that expectation. You don't make the sort of nuclear bomb on the horror market and then make another one straight after. It must have been, oh my goodness, I can't imagine. It's a bit like, not quite on the same level, but you know, Guns N' Roses were never going to make an album better than Appetite for Destruction, and boy, they tried, and boy, they never got anywhere near it.
Exactly, yeah.
Sex Pistols didn't do.
I mean, even Sam Raimi, to a certain extent, I still think Evil Dead is his best film. Maybe Evil Dead 2 in terms of how it's made, but, you know, he's still riding on that. He's the Evil Dead guy. Yeah, he did Spider-Man and everything. But it's like, I mean, I can't even remember what these guys did. I know they didn't. One of them did another film.
But that's for another conversation. Now,
absolutely.
We're going to go for number five in the list now, which is another Sam Raimi film. And one of my, this is one of my favourites of his. I've watched this film a lot of times. I've broken it down. I love it to death. It's interesting reading the screenplay for this film, because it's the whole kind of fatty before she was slim element of the script is a lot more writ large in the screenplay than it is in the in the film. It's just a kind of sidebar almost in the film. I mean, I'm talking about 2009's Drag Me to Hell. Do you want to talk? I mean, because it is a delicious, to me, it's a delicious ending as much as it's abrupt. Do you want to talk us through how it pans out and how it how it's been set up.
Yeah. It's a horror movie about a bank loan officer, and she refuses to extend the mortgage for this elderly Eastern European woman. And as a result, the old woman rips a button off a coat, puts a curse on it, and doesn't matter what happens, this button keeps turning up, which means she's still cursed.
Hmm.
And then she decides to dig up the body of the old woman who's now dead, give the button to her in an envelope. Everything's good, get a happy ending. She's at the end of the film, the curse is lifted. She's with a boyfriend on a train at the train station. I can't remember where they were going.
Well, more importantly, she's bought a new coat because obviously she's got rid of the button, so she's got a new coat on.
Yes, that's it. And so she's got a new coat, and then the boyfriend pulls out an envelope and he's like, oh, I found this. I found this in the car. And she opens the envelope and it's the cursed button. And she's in such shock that she kind of stumbles and falls back onto the tracks, and there's a train coming. And then you think, you know, oh, they're just going to like drag her off the tracks, or the train's going to hit her. But no, the ground literally opens up to hell, and all of these demonic arms sprout up. And just while her boyfriend watches on, they literally drag her to hell, which is what they literally give away the ending in the title.
Do you like my new coat?
I do. I really do. What happened to the old one, though?
I threw it out. I never want to see it again.
Oh, no. Oh, that's too bad, because look what I found. I found this in the car. I thought maybe you could, I thought maybe you could sew back on.
And I think you might have my standing liberty order.
Because the envelope's kind of like the same.
Chris, what's from us?
Every time I watch it, it always feels satisfying to me, that with the way that they gave us. I mean, it's interesting. The film took, I think, 11 years to get off the ground as well, you know, which was, you know, basically.
Did it really?
Yes. I didn't know that. Yeah. Part of making the Spider-Man films was the trade off he eventually would get to make Drag Me to Hell, I think, you know, as far as I remember.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, Sam Raimi is, you know, because he did the Spider-Man, and I love the fact that he went back to horror, just kind of go, I can still do this, and I'm still brilliant at it. Because it kind of came out of nowhere and was a massive success, as I recall.
But I don't know if you've noticed, is that with the hell scene and the train station, there is a kind of nod to the origins of Drag Me to Hell, which is, you know, although it's not credited, I mean, it's very much M.R. James casting of the runes. And therefore, right, it is also a very big nod to Night of the Demon, which is the...
Never seen it.
Oh, Night of the Demon is very much... It's literally just a piece of paper with a rune on it. And and at the end of that film, I mean, you may have seen images from it. You've got a demon riding the train. And it was a very... He looks like the Chew It monster from the 80s. But right. So it was kind of... It was kind of seen to spoil the film because it to some people, and it's a very Marmite moment. But it's definitely a callback to having her get dragged to hell at the train station as the train's approaching is a callback to Night of the Demon, which is a huge influence, I feel, on Drag Me to Hell.
Oh, right. I've never seen it. No, I didn't know that.
Oh, well, it'll blow you. It'll blow your mind. You'll realise how much of... I mean, it's a very different story, but because it's about a cynic being made into a believer, but it's still the same thing of the idea of passing on the curse is basically to, you have the power to kill someone, which is not necessarily something we embrace.
Well, I'll tell you what I loved about it. You know, it's a movie that comes out in 2009, but it's a film that could have come out in 1985. You know, all the only difference is the effects are much better and there's more CG in it and da 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 da. But it feels very old school horror. It's very Sam Raimi, just with a much bigger budget. You know, it's the kind of film he probably could have made for $100,000 in 1984. It's that kind of thing. You know, it, obviously the set pieces wouldn't have been quite as big.
No. The story itself is very straightforward. There's lots of straightforward.
It's incredibly straightforward. Yeah, but it's just a brilliantly well-made horror movie, and it's scary, and it makes you jump, and the characters are crazy, and it's like a stick of Blackpool Rock. It's just got Sam Raimi all over it. Fantastic.
But just as a closing thought on that, and also it's the whole kind of it's one of my coins or stamps? I can't remember what it is he collects, but he's putting stuff in envelopes that he collects, which obviously gets mixed up with her button, which is how we get the mistake. I mean, that whole sequence in the cemetery where she's giving back the button as she believes is exhausting. It's wonderful. It's fantastic.
It's fantastic.
Now, obviously, this is five great abrupt endings, but obviously there are a lot more than that. And you've got a couple of honourable mentions. So I'll start the clock again just to cover a couple more that you enjoyed. 2010's Buried and 2012's The Devil Inside. Do you want to talk us through what their endings are?
Buried is one of my favourite films. I mean, I'm a huge Ryan Reynolds fan anyway, but when I saw Buried, it just blew my mind. You know, it's an entire film in a coffin with just him and a phone. It's amazing. And I think it was Iraq during the conflict, and he's a truck driver. And he gets taken hostage and buried in the desert and held for ransom. And so the entire film, you see him on the phone to different people trying to find his way out, trying to get freed. And, you know, it gets set on fire, there's snakes, there's bombs dropped, and you think he has to get out. And then they kind of go, we're on our way, we're gonna save you. And you kind of start like breathing a bit easier because it's such a tense movie. And then the coffin is filling with sand and you think, my God, he's running out of time. I've got to get there really quickly. And then it ends with the guy on the phone going, oh my God, we've gone to the wrong grave. This is the other person. This isn't you. And you literally just watch the box fill with sand and it cuts to black. And Ryan Reynolds, the man you've just spent 80 or 90 minutes with, he just suffocates to death. And that's his ending. I remember I showed it to my girlfriend last year because she'd never seen it. And it ended, and she's just like, what? Is he dead? He can't be dead. He can't be dead. And I was like, he's dead. That's the ending. Because you like him so much as a character that you want him to get out of that box. And
well, also
I'm glad he didn't.
You want to see him breathe air again. You do you want to be paid back for having endured, because it is exhausting. I mean, the snake scene in particular
it's amazing.
I mean, what they say in screenwriting, put your character up a tree and throw rocks at them. Well, this one was like, he got every rock of every, for such a confined space, they managed to make a lot. And I must admit, I did a breakdown of Buried to look at how it works. Obviously, like you say, it is just it's one person in a coffin and we never go above ground. But he has all these other dramas in his life, which obviously stem from the fact that he's in a box, but... And the idea that he's a contractor, not a serving armed forces person, which is a bureaucratic problem. He's not an urgent matter. He signed a piece of paper that said we won't. And so suddenly you're almost forgetting that he's stuck in a box. You're like going, this is just ridiculous. Why don't they want to help him? And all that.
Why don't they want to help?
So before we run out of time, tell me about Devil Inside, because that's one I don't know actually. So what's the ending there? I mean, I say I don't know, as in I haven't familiarised myself with it. I saw it when it came out, but I don't remember what the end is.
It's a terrible example of an abrupt ending, because I wanted to put one on that does not work at all, and it's just dreadful.
Go on.
It's another found footage movie about possession. And it's actually quite an effective little horror movie. But you get to the end, and all the main characters are in the car driving. I can't remember whether they're driving away from something or they're driving to something. And then one of the characters in the car get possessed and grabs the wheel, intentionally crashes it. And so you assume that they're all dead. And then the film just cuts to black and it ends with a title card just going, if you want to find out more, visit this website at www.thedevilinside.com or whatever it was. And if you go onto YouTube, you can find audience reactions to The Devil Inside, to the ending, where it's just audio of people in the cinema. And the cinema just explodes with boos because it's such a awful, awful ending. It doesn't do anything. You know, it's not satisfying. It's not a good conclusion.
Actually, now you're saying it then. I haven't seen that then. I mustn't have seen it because I'd remember that. That's quite a memorable ending. I mean, had the film run out of road or was it just?
You know, I don't, it's like, it feels like they ran out of money. That's what it felt like. You know what I mean? Like, I would love to see the script and see what the ending was. Maybe the ending was really effective on paper, but it's diabolical. I mean, people have called it like the worst horror movie ever made, which I don't agree with. The writers tried to defend it, and but it's indefensible. But what the crazy thing is, that movie made $100 million off a $1 million budget.
Well,
It made so much money because, I mean, amazingly, that ending didn't ruin it. Word of mouth didn't ruin it.
Wow. Well,
so because the trailer was really good.
What do we know? Right, let me just recap then. So 5 great abrupt endings people to go and check out if they haven't, or remind themselves if they've seen them before, is Monty Python and the Holy Grail, American Werewolf in London, Evil Dead, Blair Witch Project, and Drag Me to Hell. And it just gives me to say, thank you very much, David, for giving us your thoughts on 5 great abrupt endings on the BritFlix podcast.
You're very welcome. I've really enjoyed talking about them.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.